You're listening to a Davenport After Dark podcast. Tune in every Thursday night at 10 o'clock on News Talk 106 to 108. Swaziland, or official name, the Kingdom of Swaziland, is one of two landlocked countries in South Africa, the other one being Lesotho. Now, Swaziland is gorgeous. Well, the northern part of it is absolutely beautiful. But it's also one of the poorest countries in the world. It's got a life expectancy rate of 49, which is the fourth lowest in the world, in large part due to the fact that it's also got the highest HIV infection rate of any country in the world. Officially 25%, but in some rural areas, it's as high as 72%. And despite calling itself a democracy, Swaziland is an absolute monarchy, with King Mswati III more or less in total charge. Now, during my visit there, I managed to meet, in what was a slightly covert meeting, Antrim man Stephen Donaghy, who spent the last year working for the Swaziland Coalition of Concerned Civic Organisations. His job is neither easy nor particularly safe. He's under constant surveillance by government authorities and has to be very careful about his movements. So it was quite a privilege that he took the time to sit down and explain the basics of what he did. I began by asking his assessment of the country's political system.
Swaziland is one of the last absolute monarchies in the world, and I work with the trade unions and the churches and the banned political parties to try and teach and mobilise people around areas of democracy and human rights. At the minute, the electoral system and the whole political system is based around the wishes of one man, the king, and they call it a democracy, democracy being of the people, and it simply isn't. So we're working with the people to give them some skills and to give them the courage to stand up for their rights, to stand up for what they want, so that the government of Swaziland is done by the people of Swaziland and not just by a select few.
The impression I got, and granted it's only a very cursory impression, is that the king is liked. Is it a benevolent monarchy, or is it something a little more austere?
The king is revered in terms of the culture here. Swaziland lives in a very dual system where it appears to live in the modern world, but it also lives in a very traditional world. And the king and the respect for the institution is very deep. What we're finding on the ground, though, is that the abuses of the system run by not only His Majesty, but by the people who hang around him and the chiefs, are that the people are becoming very angry. In the old African tradition, a king is a king because of his people, and there was a relationship between them. But now this has been divorced, and the people are saying, this is not our monarchy anymore. They're running it for themselves. And the people on the ground, we find, are getting angrier. Recently, at a launch of a CD, the king's eldest son, Prince Lindani, was introduced to the crowd, and he was booed off stage. This is unheard of.
Stephen, you mentioned abuses. Can you outline what abuses you're talking about?
The first main abuse will be the abuse of women. In Swazi culture, a woman is her father's daughter until she becomes her husband's wife. There is polygamy here. There is a lot of what they call multiple concurrent partnerships. So even without more than two or three wives, there will be informal relationships. This exacerbates the spread of HIV and AIDS in a massive way. Politically, there's no land rights in the country. So the people who live in the rural areas, they live on traditional land, which is run by the chief for the king. And if you show any independence, if you show any dissent, you have the ability to have your land taken off from you. And you are then expelled to seven chieftaincies away. Now, you have to understand, in a cultural sensitivity where we have ancestor worship here, it means that you're no longer buried with your ancestors. And that's the real fear. But the bigger thing is that because it's a poor country with a very rich elite, the king here and his people around him, they have the ability to give you a job. And the public sector is the way to richness here. There's no culture and there's no way to work yourself out. So they keep themselves in power through oppression and through privilege. There are human rights abuses. People die in jails and in prison fairly regularly. Protesters are beaten up. Any sort of trade unionists are assaulted. Political parties are banned. There is no access to the media here. All the state media is the radio and television, all run by the government for the government. There's no ability to say we want something different.
Can you prioritise what the democracy movement in Swaziland is looking to accomplish?
We're looking to accomplish, at the very basic level, a system of governance where political parties are allowed to operate and you have multi-party, so that people are able to vote for a party and to vote for a political philosophy. That doesn't come as on its own. It's part of then of a package where you have proper accountability to the people through respect for human rights, an independent judiciary, a parliament that has control over the government. And we need to get all of these things, but at the start it just has to be the people voting for the people they want and the government they want. At the minute, no matter who they vote for, the king gets to decide, the prime minister, he gets to appoint 10 parliamentarians and two-thirds of the Senate. And so everything is revolved around him maintaining and controlling power at a very tight level.
Can you expand a little on the HIV crisis that is here in Swaziland? Because, and when we say crisis, we really mean a crisis.
You really mean a crisis here. This has got the highest prevalence of HIV in the world, which is the percentage of people infected. The official figures vary depending on how you measure them, but it's around 29 to 40%. However, if you go into the rural areas in the south of the country, we're working with some of the clinics there, and we're hearing figures of 75-85%. And these are like rural areas in the sugar belt, and there's very little access to condoms. There's very little access to the education, and if there is, the education that we get is so poor. It's based on an American model of we tell you what to do and you just do it, whereas African culture and sex is a very different thing.
I noticed coming in at the border, as my passport was being stamped, there was also a dispensary giving out free condoms. Have the government, beyond just handing out free condoms, taken on the issue of how to deal with HIV at all?
They have, of course. They've spent millions and millions of dollars, of euros, of pounds on campaigns and on treatment. There have been some successes, let's not be completely negative. The biggest success is the reduction of the treatment of infection from pregnant women to their children. And that's been a success. But the actual number of new infections isn't going down. Or technically, it went down from 2.6% to 2.4%. It's like having an alcoholic friend who was drinking 26 whiskies a day, and they went into rehab for 3 years in the most expensive places in the world, and they came out drinking 24.
In a country where you have polygamy that is patriarchal, male-dominated, do you find that you're having a lot of on-the-ground resistance to any change you want to make to what they might term local traditions and culture?
Yes and no. The people who are benefiting from this, they do obviously resist. But we do most of our work in the rural communities with women and young people, the people who are disenfranchised. And the only way forward in most of Africa, not just Swaziland, is the development of girl children. It's seen by study after study to be the most successful way. Of course, you're going to change when you're doing political work like this and human rights work like this. But that's part of the nature, that you have to figure out where the power is and how you empower the people to take stuff for themselves, because nobody is coming from outside to give the ordinary Swazis this power. They have to understand it's theirs to take.
And Stephen, a word about yourself. You're a northern man. Tell me a bit about where you came from and what brought you here.
I born in Belfast, brought up in Port Stewart in County Derry. Got a degree in law from Newcastle upon Tyne, and then worked in a number of jobs, ending up primarily as a management consultant. And I had the perfect Western middle class life. I had a house by the sea, I played golf at the weekends, I had a Saab car and Boss suits, but I was a bit bored. And one day I met a friend, and his brother was doing some work in Africa, and I thought, that might be interesting. So I applied with an organisation called Skillshare, who still have an office in Dublin. And this job in Swaziland became available, and it was just perfect. It had law, it had management, it had group work, it had a whole lot of skills that I'd sort of picked up on my way. So I applied and was lucky enough to be accepted. That was June 2007, and I haven't got out yet. I'm still here.
So it's interesting, and I suppose, you know, you'll allow me the preconception to think that because you're a northern man, you might have a bit of background in conflict resolution in the north.
Yeah. Yes, and conflict is a huge issue here. Culturally, conflict is not solved by the way we would solve it at home. You know, we say in Ireland, you know, your real friend is a friend that'll stab you in the front. And here, conflict is run away from. And so I can't teach the Swazis too much. There's a lot of intelligent people here with masters and doctorates. But in terms of how to approach things, that's where it comes from. The Irish love of a good fight. And, you know, the fact that our friends speak openly and plainly is not culturally appropriate here. And sometimes that then causes them problems. Whereas when we approach conflict in a more mature way, and rather than denying that it exists, which we've obviously had to do in Northern Ireland, and yes, I have done a bit of work in peace and reconciliation through the years there too, that the skills from Northern Ireland were very useful coming here.
Swaziland is not a country that features large on the radar of aid, certainly from Europe and particularly from Ireland. So do you find it a frustrating experience trying to get the message out of here and to a European public?
Historically, a lot of the connections with Western governments have come through where the missionaries came from. And the Irish missionaries were mainly in Lesotho. And so there's great connections between Lesotho, which is the next small country over from us. So it does become frustrating. You know, there's only ever one story a week about Africa, and there's 54 countries in Africa. So it's difficult to get our story out. But we try and we use tricks, and sometimes we get frustrated. You know, we had a great story one week just around the elections, and we find out that it's the day President Mbeki had resigned. And so our story went out. Everybody said, good, but we're not carrying it. What Robert Mugabe does quite often trumps our attempts to get stuff out. Swaziland is small, but the problems are becoming bigger. The orphans and orphan and vulnerable children, because of HIV and AIDS, are coming to 200,000 in a population of 1 million. Those young boys and young girls are going to become...
That's one-fifth of the population.
One-fifth of the population either has no parents or just one parent. There are so many child-headed households in the rural areas. If you go down there, you'll see kids of 8 and 9 looking after their smaller brothers. The parents are dead. The communities are fractured. It's a massive problem waiting to happen.
Hang on a second. So without being too pessimistic, you have one-fifth of the population that is in a state of near orphanage. You have an HIV infection rate of anywhere depending between 30 and 70%. You have 60% of the population, I've been told, earn a dollar or thereabouts a day. How do you stay hopeful?
You don't sometimes. You know, when you look at it that way, you say, is it easier to give up or is it easier to go on? You can't give up and just let these things slide. You know, you have to... It's not people like me that will save Swaziland, it's the Swazis. So you have to give them the skills to save themselves.
And it's to that I wanted to ask you, is like, to what degree have you been successful in bringing Swazis together, either as unions or groups of action or nascent political parties?
It's a very difficult thing. A lot of people here have seen the success of the ANC in South Africa and are trying to replicate that. But nobody's Mandela here, and nobody's the ANC, and nobody can deliver it on their own. So trying to get people to work, to give up a little bit of the ego to work in the common good has been a challenge, but we're getting there. And we're getting there with some very unusual support. The South African Council of Catholic Bishops has a Dennis Hurley Peace Institute run by a Dublin man called Father Sean O'Leary. And he's been doing a lot of good work in the background on these things. It's not easy. Left-wing organisations classically split. Right-wing ones stay together for the sake of power. And we're dealing with primarily left-wing organisations who are ideologically pure. But they are starting to learn that by coming together, they will achieve a lot more. We've seen the lessons in Syria over the last 2 weeks where the opposition united and was immediately internationally recognised. And these are the lessons that we're getting the Swazi opposition to learn.
There you go. That is Stephen Donaghy of the Swaziland Coalition of Concerned Civic Organisations, born in Port Stewart, County Derry, rather than County Antrim, which is what I said earlier. Absolutely remarkable man indeed. It was a real privilege to get to talk to him. That was a Davenport After Dark podcast, live every Thursday night at 10 p.m. on News Talk 106 to 108 FM.